equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon, I'm Carl Etnair, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil.
We have a great show coming up for you today. We're going to hear from Jennifer Wallace Broder. She's the Associate State Director of AARP in Vermont. She's going to explain what transportation choices their members want to see. They are running a project called Transporting the Public, which is building a coalition to increase transportation choices in the state. So we'll find out more about that. Also, the Button Up Vermont program, it's in its second season now. Vermonters are learning to save heating dollars in their own homes. Paul Markowitz coordinates the program, and he'll talk about what it's all about and upcoming workshops. Upcoming in November, the two-hour workshops are scheduled in Westford, Chelsea, Tinmouth, South Burlington, Putney, Thetford, Starksboro, Huntington, Hardwick, Greensboro, Waterbury, and Warren, Waitsfield. One workshop for the two towns. But first, regrets from Buggy Bacaw for missing last week's show.
I got a text from him during the course of the show, and he had a terrible high fever, was feeling horrible, was at the doctor's office, and being on the radio with us was the last thing on his mind. So he apologizes for that, and maybe we'll try to get him back some other time when he's feeling better. But we had some callers call in, and Henry from Moortown talked about getting a dozen eggs that were all double yolked. Every single egg in the package was a double yolked egg. And he wondered, how is that possible? How frequent are they? Well, I didn't ask Bucky about it. I just let him recover. But I did do a little bit of research myself. And the best that I could find was a paper in the Journal of Theoretical and Applied Genetics from January 1967. Called The Incidence of Double Yolked Eggs in Relation to Improvement in Egg Production. Now, the abstract, a little bit about the paper, was available for free on the internet. I would have had to pay to get the whole paper. I didn't do that, but here's what I found reading through the abstract, the first page, and trying to understand what the author, who is, I had it here somewhere. Thought I had it here somewhere. She's Dorothy Lowry. She's at the Department of Poultry Husbandry, University of California in Berkeley, or at least she was in January 1967. And isn't that interesting that an urban place like Berkeley, California has, or at least in 1967, had a Department of Poultry Husbandry that sort of puts backyard chickening, urban chickening in a new light. Anyway, she was saying that the incidence of double yolked eggs has increased in the time that it's been monitored, which I believe was since the 1940s sometime. So from the 1940s to the late 1960s, it had increased. Nobody completely understood why. And it was about 3% in the first 4 months of laying. And apparently laying a double yolked egg is something that happens as the young pullets are just getting their reproductive system in order, and not everything is completely firing at the time that it's supposed to, and you get two yolks inserted into the same shell sometime, and after that it drops off infrequently, quite from what I understand. So anyway, it's about 3%. So Henry, the chance of getting 12 double yolked eggs in the same carton completely at random sounds like it'd be 3 to the 12th. It'd be 3% to the 12th. It'd be pretty small. I haven't calculated it. One in a million or more, I'd guess. I doubt they got there at random. In my small experience with backyard chickens, the two double yolked eggs that I've gotten from my pullets are considerably different in size, considerably bigger than the other ones. Easy to tell apart. When I cracked open the second one, I said to myself, this is going to be another double yolked egg. I imagine the person that sold you that carton of double yolked eggs knew that these were all going to be double yolked eggs, put them all together, and had one carton of eggs that were the same size. Interestingly enough, from what I read, the industry considers double yolked eggs to be a problem, and they try to sort them out, make sure that they go to egg products. They don't go to the consumer as raw eggs, because people might complain that they get double yolked eggs, I guess. But here in Vermont, where we understand that double yolked eggs are just as good, for some purposes even better than single yolked eggs, you can sometimes find them, the eggs you get from the local farmers or your own backyard. Anyway, that's it for double yolked eggs. Thanks for your call, Henry, and thanks everybody for your calls. Now we're going to go to the phone to our first guest, Jennifer Wallace Broder, the Associate Director of the AARP. Jennifer, welcome to Equal Time.
Thanks a lot, Carl. Thanks for having me.
So I was hesitant to just say AARP or to say out the name of the organization, but I understand that it only goes by the initials now. Is that correct?
That's right. We're not an acronym anymore, and that's partly because we have members 50 and older.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be the American Association of Retired Persons, and that wasn't really a great descriptor of who our members are any longer. Because, as I said, we have members 50 and older. We also have people that are retiring a lot later in life. It's a trend that we're seeing. And so it really wasn't a great description of who we are.
Hmm. And the initials AARP have gotten well enough known that I saw last week that Sesame Street had celebrated its 40th birthday. It's been around so long that the anniversary celebration was being sponsored by the letters AARP.
Oh, that's so funny. I didn't realize that. That's great.
So anyway, we're going to talk about transportation policy, which is not something that one thinks about in connection with the AARP, or at least I don't generally. But let's sort something out. In the healthcare debate, AARP has come under some criticism for marketing insurance policies and having not the best interest of their members at heart, but the best interest of insurance companies. Let's look at transportation. Do you get any funding from automobile insurance?
We do have a relationship with insurance companies and related to auto insurance. And the reason we do is that people probably don't remember this, or maybe our older members do, but at one point it was almost impossible to get automobile insurance as an older driver.
Hmm.
And so AARP actually believes in using the market for social change and felt that it wasn't right that folks couldn't get access to automobile insurance, and so developed a relationship to provide that fill that consumer need, and so we do have a relationship with auto insurance.
And yet you have this big policy on transporting the public, which goes way beyond the private automobile, promoting other types of transportation.
Maybe
you could begin by explaining the difference between transporting the public, the title of your project, and public transportation, and then let us know what's happening with the project as a whole.
Sure. Well, what folks are probably familiar with is that as people get older, particularly when they get pretty late in life, maybe, you know, mid-70s and older, driving becomes more difficult, and a lot of people choose not to drive. A lot of people have difficult family conversations where children are concerned about their parents driving and wish they wouldn't drive as much. And what we don't like to see is that when somebody drives, they pretty much give up their entire life and their quality of life because there are so few options for some people to get where they'd like to go and maintain their connection to the community. So we're coming at the transportation issue from that perspective, the perspective that giving up a car shouldn't mean giving up your entire quality of life. And for too many people in Vermont, particularly a rural state like Vermont, it's very difficult to get where you want to go without getting in your car.
Mm. We have, if I recall correctly, we have about the highest number of vehicle miles traveled per person of any state in the country. Is that right?
We do have a pretty high vehicle miles traveled. I believe it's about on a daily average over 50 miles. Folks are driving in Vermont, and we also have a high number of people that are driving alone.
Hmm.
So you can imagine what kind of an impact that has on our environment, for example. So there are a number of interests that we think are sort of converging at this time for us to really take a look at how people get around the state.
Hmm.
So it's not just about older people who need to get where they need to go. Obviously, that's a very high concern for a lot of people. But we also have a lot of people driving alone. We have a very high contribution from CO2 emissions to climate change. That's a concern for a lot of folks. And folks are really sort of dealing with pretty high gas prices and a high cost of transportation. One of the things that I have learned from this project is that The estimated cost to own and operate a personal vehicle is over $7,000 a year. And for many people, that's just way too much money. They can't afford to have a car.
Yeah, that's hard for people to see because it's neither in the price of the gas nor in the price of the sticker price of the car,
all
of it, but it's in the insurance and in the maintenance of it and all these and the registration and all these
that's
little
right.
dribbles and drabbles.
And then just the price of gas up the car. I think we spent over $1.2 billion in petroleum alone in Vermont last year. Just crazy.
Which went up.
Think about it.
Yeah,
a lot
and
one
of your materials, you talked about how much that went up since the year 2002.
Right. It's almost doubled.
Right.
So, and that's a lot of money that's going out of our local economy in some cases to, you know, oil companies. And
we don't have a lot of oil drilling
of
here in Vermont. So,
right.
Yeah, most of that's going out of state. Okay, so yeah, and as you said, there's a lot of interest in various aspects of transporting the public, and quickly, there's no accident that when I saw you on Saturday talking about this project that you were teamed up with Brian Shoup, who's now with the Vermont Natural Resources Council,
right.
the environmental community.
Right. Well, what we actually initiated this project that you've been referring to called Transporting the Public earlier this year because we in the aging community and the aging network in Vermont have been dealing with transportation issues for a long time. We know that for many Vermonters, getting to the doctor, getting to the grocery store, if you don't have a car, is a real challenge. And there's a myriad of programs trying to get people where they need to go, and it can be very complicated and frustrating for people that want to get around. And in many cases, people just choose to stay at home and have to deal with issues around isolation. We thought, you know, we've really got to tackle this issue, but who else might be interested in this? Who else might have some concerns about transportation that could help us add some political force behind this? And so, as I said, there are a number of interests that are sort of converging. So environmentalists have an interest in transportation because as I said, there's the transportation sector is the highest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in Vermont. And so there are a number of people that are aware of that and would like to see more alternatives to single occupancy driving. And the outcomes, how you would address that, are very similar for how you would address the issues of people not being able to drive who are older. Gas prices and issues related to that are getting people to start thinking about, it's getting very expensive for me to drive, but do I really have another option if I want to cut back a little bit? And a lot of people are saying no, they don't have options if they didn't want to drive as much. And then the other area that I think is really important is that Vermont, like many states, are looking at transportation from a public health perspective. And we'd actually like people to make this connection more, but if you look at the number of obese people in this country and in Vermont, those numbers are growing, and it's in part due to the fact that we're driving more and walking and biking less. And so folks in the public health community are saying, well, what do we need to do in our communities to encourage more physical activity? So there's a number of things that are sort of coming together and making us all think, if we can put these on the agenda, the solutions are pretty much the same. The way that people are coming at it is different, but if you look at what to do about it, the solutions are very similar for all of these interests. So we thought it made sense to get everybody together and start talking about this and developing a common agenda.
Well, one of the things I really like about the way you talk about transportation is a need for more options, for more choices for Vermonters. This is about increasing the choices that we have to us.
Right. Well, I always say, you know, it's not fair to ask people to do something different if the alternatives aren't really viable.
So
a lot of people do worry about, for example, maybe the fact that they would like to drive less, they're worried about the environment maybe, but what are there really seriously viable options available to them in their community? And oftentimes there aren't. So it's not really fair to say, well, you got to change your behavior, you got to do something differently, when there's really not a robust set of options available.
Right. When I'm finished up with a show that I'm going to work here at the station for a little while, and then at 3:30 I'll get on the GMTA bus that will take me to Montpelier, and I'll transfer to Barrie, and I'll go to a project in Barrie that way, so that's available to me.
Right.
But I would have had to take a 9 o'clock bus this morning for the 1 o'clock show if I was going to take the bus here. Now, I'm fit. I take the bicycle here from East Montpelier,
wow.
and that works for me.
Right.
But there are a lot of people who might want to make the trip who wouldn't want a bicycle here.
That's right.
Would see that as a distance. So options are necessary.
There are definitely more. And, you know, this isn't something you can turn the switch on immediately. It's going to take a long time to build up those options. But we really think it's important to start building that type of public awareness and support for other options.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Jennifer Wallace Broder. She is the Associate State Director for AARP here in Vermont. If you'd like to join the program, the local number is 244-1777. The toll-free number is 877-291-8255. Well, Jennifer, it's not just you and I talking about the need for more options and these other groups that you mentioned that you've allied with in the Transporting the Public project.
Uh-huh.
You also did a phone survey of Vermonters in January of this year. Could you talk about that?
Sure. We wanted to get a better understanding of where Vermonters were coming from on this issue and sort of how they're getting around the state currently and what they might see as an appropriate state role to respond to some of these issues. So we did a phone survey of 800 people age 18 and older at the beginning of this year and asked a bunch of questions about, you know, what they were concerned about. What I found interesting in this is one that a very large percentage of people are concerned about vehicle emissions contributing to global warming. About 73% of Vermonters said they were worried about that, and a pretty high number, 40%, were extremely or very worried about that. So that gives me a sense that, you know, some of these issues will resonate with people when we start talking about it. We did also find that people are changing, you know, driving less. We did the survey soon after the gas prices were pretty high, and a lot of people remember when gas was around $4 a gallon, and people really started to think about, okay, I can't maintain this for very long, so what am I going to do? And a lot of people just chose to drive less, and that was reflected in this poll. And we also found that a number of people were pretty interested in seeing the state step up and offer some alternatives to respond to some of these issues. So that gave us a sense that there's ground to begin engaging Vermonters on these issues and that these issues will resonate.
I thought it was fascinating. You were saying on Saturday that 3/4 of the people that you talked to believe that the state has a role in providing alternatives to the car. That's pretty strong support for a state role there.
I thought so. I think that there is sort of a common feeling that to talk about transportation can sometimes be controversial and hard because people are very wedded to their cars and to the way of life that is represented and facilitated by their car. And I think that, as I said, it's hard to actually talk to people about doing something differently when they just really don't see that there's a good choice for them.
Mm.
But if you can begin to say, well, what if there were more choices and what those would look like, I think you'd have some openness to people seeing the state helping to provide some of those alternatives.
And when it comes to, you know, some AARP members, the poll you said on Saturday said that 90% of the respondents said that the state should help people who are no longer able to drive. That's really strong support.
That's really strong support. And I think that the state does, the policymakers do spend a good deal of time thinking about that constituency, people who are older or disabled and are really unable to get around. So they do really think of that as a constituency for public transit, for example, volunteer driver programs. Medicaid is actually a big funder of public transportation in Vermont, helping people who don't have cars or can't drive get to their doctor's appointments. So we do have policy, and there are public discussions about getting people around who can't drive. So the number was really high So it's surprising in that regard, but it also is sort of consistent with where the policy discussions have been.
And it's consistent with what policy has been, not just the discussions. I mean, when I get on this bus to go to Barrie after the show, I'm going to pay $2 for that. And I believe that I've been told that that will cover maybe a quarter of the cost of providing that service. So the state's already funding that. You mentioned Medicaid funding of taking people to doctor's offices.
Right.
So did you get any sense from the poll as to whether people wanted to see an increased role for the state in public transportation?
We actually asked them very specifically, you know, under what conditions are the things that people would like to see the state get involved with. And as we talked about, you know, people not being able to drive was a population that people were interested in trying to find solutions for. Finding solutions that addressed vehicle emissions was another one. Another was we did get a lot of people say the state should provide alternatives if gas prices continue to rise. So these are things that conditions that would motivate people to support policy change. So I think those are important to keep in mind. We also found that when we asked people, well, are there good alternatives to driving? About 54% said no in
for
their
them.
Community. And I actually thought that was kind of a low number, to be honest with you.
Me too.
Kind of interesting. But still, it's a majority of people saying that. And then those folks that said that, a majority supported having more alternatives in their community.
Well, you're trying to put together a package of policy options that a lot of groups in your coalition can get behind when the legislative season comes up again in January.
Right.
But before you get to that, could you just tell a story that you told on Saturday about the doctor's offices on Tilley Drive in Burlington, which illustrates so much of the problem?
Right. Well, there's medical facilities off of Hinesburg Road. People in Chittenden County might be familiar with this area, but it's basically off the beaten track. There isn't public transit that serves that area, and where there is public transit, if you wanted to walk from the closest bus stop to the doctor's office, there were no sidewalks. So basically, doctor's offices were located in an area where, unless you could drive, they were inaccessible.
So this builds in costs to us for Medicaid, for example, for reimbursing people for taking taxi cabs
to
get there.
Well, I did a drive around with SSTA, which is Special Services Transportation Authority in Chittenden County that provides rides for people who can't drive, and there were two or three of their vans in that facility when we went through it. And the thing that really got me was that there are porticos by the doors, and the vans can't fit under them. So it just was really, it's a great example of how people, when they're planning developments, and particularly a regional facility like these doctor's offices, never was there a consideration of how are people going to get here that can't drive, and do we have the services to support them? What's one of the solutions that's been talked about for that is to add a bus route. Well, it's going to cost one community for this regional, what's truly a regional service, upwards to $100,000 to add a bus route there. So the lack of planning for transportation, for all modes of transportation, can be quite expensive.
And you're saying that Act 250 doesn't take this into account at all?
In the criteria for Act 250, you have to address traffic. So if you have a project that's going to add a lot of cars to the road, then you've got to document that, and you may be asked to, for example, add a light to facilitate traffic, safe traffic flow. But there's no consideration for transit specifically. So the transportation agency, if you have a regional transit provider, is never asked to weigh in on a development that's under Act 250 review and say, we don't service this, for example. We don't have a route here.
Sounds like a problem.
So that it's a kind of inadequate in that regard.
So is a change in Act 250 something you're going to ask the legislature for?
Well, it's something that is definitely being discussed. We're not taking the lead on that, but we would be likely to support it. We would like to see land use development tools that we have in our arsenal as a state. Act 250, the Growth Center program is another good example. Any of these sort of permitting tools, we really think should have some criteria, if you want to call it, or standards, or something that addresses access by alternate modes, so public transportation, connectivity of bike paths and sidewalks. Are these, you know, if you can't drive, can you get there by some other mode, and are those built into the project?
We're talking to Jennifer Wallace Broder. She is the Associate State Director for the AARP. We're going to Jericho on the phones now. Chuck's calling. Hello, Chuck.
Hi. I guess what I have to say is not a rebuttal in any way, but an and to the in addition to the conversation, which is, and I would love to see AARP talk about this, and that is that, you know, I think people in their 50s should start thinking about this, you know, 20, 30 years in advance, and start looking at their constellation of relationships and work on building a generous community around them. I have six or seven role models for people who are in their 80s who did that, and who, you know, in my town, who, you know, were the first ones there helping younger couples with kids. And, you know, in terms of their social strata, just didn't stick within their own age group, but worked at having, really worked at having relationships with people of all ages. And now that they're in their 80s, they have people who, for whom it is a joy to help them. You know, I have people who helped me with my kids, and now they're in their 80s, and I'm in my early 50s, and it is a complete joy for me to help them, drive them anywhere. There was one woman who's passed away now, but when she got cancer, it was just a snap of the fingers, and there were 10, 12, 15 people eager to take her to her chemo sessions.
Build friends, build a community. If you want to get academic about it, you can call it building social capital. Jennifer Wallace Broder, what do you have to say about that?
I think that's a great comment. I think one of the things that we see sometimes is that people are reluctant to ask for assistance, but often folks that feel they have contributed might be more willing to ask, and that just makes such a huge difference. But our research shows us that as people, when people stop driving, they become passengers. And I think if you think about what that entails, particularly if you don't have family nearby, oftentimes it's hard to ask for things. I'm really, really happy to hear that story of people that are willing to ask and willing to reach out to the community for support, but not everybody's willing to do that.
Yeah. Am I still on?
Yes.
Yeah. I would like to see AARP, I mean, maybe take a more proactive view on that, and that as a complement to your advocacy in terms of, you know, you're asking people, should the state be helping people? And yeah, sure, of course.
Right.
But it's not just about family, people who don't have family in the community, but that it is incumbent upon people to develop that community around them,
right,
and not to be, the passivity, I think, comes when you're waiting for the state to do something for you.
Right. So you think the AARP can provide tools for people to get involved in their 50s with people who are younger than them and build these relationships?
Not even that. Just telling the stories.
Telling the stories, okay.
This is something that people need to do for themselves.
Right.
The architecture of people help, you know, that people need to set up their own architecture and be proactive about it in you know, in their own community building.
Yeah.
That my mother is in her early 80s and just sold her farm and is moving up with us, and has already reached out to a bunch of people in the community that she, you know, people that she's going to farm with. I mean, it's something that she just does. It's just something that she does instinctually, and has always had people of all ages. And I don't think it's about someone setting up, you know, introducing people or anything like that. It's about saying to people, you have this responsibility not to be this, a grumpy old person.
Okay. Thanks so much for your call, Chuck. That's a good point, and it's about telling
really
stories, and maybe that's what we should be doing more of on Equal Time. I'll think about ways to tell more of those stories here on the show.
Those are great stories because people can sort of close in and stop reaching out to the community, particularly when they start losing their mobility. And so that's a really good point, is that people need to work at staying connected, and it's very important. And, you know, a lot of what we do at ARP is policy-related, but a lot of how people are going to get around in the future and currently are is through those informal social networks of connecting with friends and family and catching rides with other people and asking for rides with other people.
Well, Jennifer, our time's about up, and we didn't get a chance to talk about what you'll be looking for in state policy changes this time, but already at the EqualTimeRadio.com website, I've put a link to your Transporting the Public project that you and the Snelling Center are working on with this broad coalition
Excellent. You've
put together. So people can go to EqualTimeRadio.com and find out more about it. And I believe your contact information will be at that link too. I assume you welcome inquiries.
We absolutely do. We welcome inquiries and ideas. I think this is something that a lot of people need to start thinking about and engaging with. And it's not going to be solved overnight. So good ideas are always welcome.
Jennifer Wallace Broder, the Associate State Director for AARP in Vermont, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
And coming up next, we'll be talking about a little bit of what Chuck was talking about, neighbors helping neighbors here in Vermont to tighten up their homes. Mostly we'll be talking about how people can learn enough to tighten up their own homes through the Button Up Project, Button Up Vermont, a series of two-hour workshops being held around the state. A lot of them are being held this month. Our guest will be Paul Markowitz. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettenayer, your Monday host. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy. At the end of the age of oil, we're going to be talking about energy continuing in the last part of the show. Paul Markowitz does all sorts of things related to energy with VCAN, Vermont Energy Climate Action Network, with VEIC, Vermont Energy Investment Corporation, with the Sierra Club, and probably with others. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. It's nice to be here.
Did I cover most of your major hats?
I sometimes get lost in what hats I got, on my hook there.
Okay. Well, I asked you on to talk about the Button Up Vermont program, but following up on Chuck's call, I did mention before the break the Community Energy Mobilization Program, I believe is the name of it. Could you just briefly tell us what that is and what's going on with that right now?
Oh, sure. Right now we have a request out for communities to send in applications. And the Community Energy Mobilization Project is a program where volunteers go into people's houses, install low-flow shower heads, compact fluorescent bulbs, a few other energy-saving products, do a walk-through energy assessment to identify energy-saving opportunities in the home, and then sit down with homeowners to share their information and pass on resources and information on how to improve the efficiency of their homes. So this is really a neighbor helping neighbor program. We train the volunteers. This is a program led by Efficiency Vermont, done in partnership with communities. So we train the volunteers, and communities basically find the volunteers, they find the participants, and then they kind of do the matchmaking in terms of setting up these visits. And then we provide the materials, the energy-saving products, free of charge to be installed. This is the second year we're running the program. We worked in 14 communities last year. Participants, people who had these home energy visits, were very, very pleased. I want to make it clear that this is not an energy audit. This is like a prelude to an audit where they identify some very basic savings opportunities. And oftentimes recommend that folks proceed with getting a more official audit done. So the applications are, we're soliciting applications from town energy committees, community groups who would be interested in partnering with Efficiency Vermont. And I don't know if I can give information on where to get that, if that's appropriate.
Well, if somebody's listening out in Moortown or Jericho or Waitsfield and would like to see this program start up in their community, what should they do?
Probably the easiest is just to contact me, and
okay.
I can give you that. You want phone number, email? What would you like?
Why don't we get both?
Okay, so my phone number is 229-6307.
6307?
229-6307.
Yep.
And my email is paul@markowitzvt.com. MARKOWITZVT, like state, .com.
Paul@markowitzvt.com.
Right,
and I'll add this to the
request.
Equal Time Radio website after the show so that people who miss it here can go to equaltimeradio.com and get it. And I was thinking they might want to call their local energy committee or select board members. Would that be a good strategy,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, they have an energy committee. And if you don't know if you have an energy committee, you can contact me and I can let you know about that. It doesn't have to be an energy committee. It could be any kind of volunteer group in a community conservation commission.
Okay.
You know, somebody maybe, you know, doing social, you know, helping out, you know, folks, you know, the elderly, whoever.
Does it need to be associated with the municipality, or can it be like the Kiwanis? Or?
No, we ask that they end up having some affiliation with a nonprofit, but they don't have to be a nonprofit. It can be just a committee, a local committee in town.
Got it. So if you're thinking that, you know, Chuck really had a great idea, that the way to build a good network around you for transportation for other reasons when you get into your 80s and can't do so much for yourself, perhaps, is to start investing in people who are younger than you now, then this would be a good opportunity. You could go to the homes of people who are much younger than you, if you're in your 50s, say, and help them tighten them up and save them some money.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Okay. And one more time, the name of the program is the...
Vermont... Community Energy Mobilization Project.
Very good. But we're here mostly to talk about the Button Up Vermont program. That's
right.
Kind of similar but different. What's that about?
Well, this is basically a series of workshops that are being delivered around the state. About 40 have been done to date. Another 30, 35 are scheduled. And the workshops focus on how your home loses energy, and things that you can do to save energy, both things that people, you know, people with basic handy person skills can do, as well as things that don't cost you very much, like turning back your thermostat, as well as what types of benefits and services that a professional energy auditor and, you know, energy retrofitter, you know, person providing comprehensive energy efficiency services can provide as well. And then we hand you, you know, provide you with all sorts of resources and information. The workshops are done. They're led by certified energy professionals. We have provided them with a PowerPoint, a slideshow presentation that goes through these topics. The other thing that we show at the workshops is a DVD that we prepared, a half-hour DVD, which basically follows two energy professionals through a house, and you see step-by-step on how to basically address air leaks in your home and things that if you have some basic skills, for instance, you know, tightening up the attic hatch or fixing your bulkhead door, where the box sill is, where your foundation meets your sill, some of those places there, with basically a foam gun and, you know, a screwdriver and the saw and some basic, you know, skills, you can really make a big difference.
That DVD, that's new this year, isn't it?
That's new this year, right? This is the second year that this program, Button Up, is being run. You know, last year we had 2,700 people attend. We did 100 workshops. People were really, really pleased. You know, I think the big message out there, Carl, is that people, most Vermonters, and I would say a significant number of homes, have serious energy savings available. And, you know, people have this notion, oh, I've got 12 inches of insulation in my attic, I'm all set. Wrong. And what we talk about in the workshop is that, you know, a lot of the energy loss in your home comes in the attic and in your basement. And not just by conductive heat loss, you know, when your hand touches when you touch a cold surface, you can feel that transfer of heat. That's what insulation addresses. But you lose it by energy leaks, leaking in holes in your attic, as well as leaks in your basement.
And that's air flowing.
Air flowing, that's right. Air flowing through, and air flows through insulation. So if there's air movement, that doesn't really stop the, you know, insulation does not stop the flow of air movement. So if you just look at an attic hatch, if you've just got a board it's sitting on top of your hatch there, the air is moving. You know, where you have two pieces of wood move, air moves through that. You know, just like you'd have weather stripping around your, you know, doors and windows, et cetera, you'd want to have that there. If you look in your attic, you know, the plumbing vent pipe, that was a good one. You know, off plumbers might often drill, you know, a 3 or 4 inch hole for a 2 inch pipe. All that gap that's between where the pipe is and the hole, air is leaking through that. So you have all sorts of places in your attic where the air leaks through. Where your box, where your sill meets your foundation, air is screaming through those two places.
But we had our house renovated some years back to make it more energy efficient, amongst other things. And before the job started, the contractor went up to the second floor and drilled a hole through the floor just to take a look at the state of the joists there, how big they were and so on. It was kind of a windy day, and he just saw dust blowing through the area between the second floor and the ceiling on the first floor. It was really quite a wind up there, apparently. Right. That's an old, typical old Vermont farmhouse, I guess.
Right. I mean, here's another thing that I'd really ask your listeners to think about is energy efficiency is an investment. You know, just like you would take your money, you put a little money away and you're going to put it in your savings account or a treasury note or something else. You know, and the savings that are achievable through efficiency improvements in your house, we're talking 10, 15, 20% return on your money. I mean, as far as I know, there's no better place you can put your money right now than investing in efficiency in your house. And we're talking most houses. The vast majority of Vermont houses, whether you're new or whether you're old, unless it was built to some type of, you know, efficiency standards, you know, some of these energy-rated homes within the higher level, then there are significant savings opportunities in your home.
Hmm. And the only way you're going to lose money on that investment is, well, I suppose if you do a bad job. But if you do a good job, follow the instructions with these simple things that you can do, the only way you're going to lose money is if the price of energy radically drops, which not too many people expect to happen.
No, the price of energy is going to keep going up. Yeah. There's little doubt about that, especially as, you know, the world economy picks up a little bit.
Well, you said 2,700 people went through these workshops last year here in Vermont. I was one of them, and I went more as a curious member of our local energy committee than anything else, and so I didn't do anything in response. I'd done the work some years before, but have you followed up? Do you know how many of those people actually made changes in their houses?
Well, we did a follow-up survey, and of the people who responded, over 20% said they had moved ahead and made significant energy improvements. And we're not just talking about you know sealing up their windows. I mean, we're talking about significant upgrades.
Mm.
So 97% left the workshop saying they were going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that, in other words, they learned something. And so, you know, it's like an hour, maybe 2 hours of your time, and it's like, you know, how might I be able to save $100, $300, $500 this year on my heating bill?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you think about how much your time is worth, and I guarantee anybody who comes to this workshop is going to find something they can do. You know, and we talk about basic things like turning back your thermostat. There's still a misconception out there, some circles, that it doesn't make sense to turn back your thermostat at night because it takes more energy to bring your house back up to temperature, you know, let's say in the morning.
Wrong.
You know, and the what we calculate is that for every 5 degrees you turn back your thermostat, so let's say you turn it back from 70 to 65 at night when you go to sleep, for an 8-hour period over the heating season, you can save 5% of your energy bill. So, and, you know, because when you're under your covers, you don't need to have your thermostat up. You know, you don't need that.
So, for what was that, for every 5 degrees you turn
five
it back?
Degrees.
It's 5% off your heating.
Over just an 8-hour period. If you if you turn it back when you go to work for 16 hours, you're going to save 10% of your energy bill by turning it back 5%. So, and then there are these programmable thermostats out there that, you know, have timers on them and set it back. So,
so you don't have to think about it.
You can come home to a warm house, so it kicks in before you even get home, or, you know, kicks on before you wake up in the morning.
I have one of those programmable thermostats. I programmed it once when I was away in December to just bring the whole house down to 42 degrees for a week if it got that cold, because I didn't need it warm, and 42 degrees was plenty to keep the water pipes from freezing, I thought. And then 4 hours before I came home, just kicked the temperature back up, so it was a comfortable temperature when
I got home. Yeah, that's great. So we talk about, you know, very simple, basic things that you can do to save energy. Don't cost very little or nothing like that. We talk about what you can do in terms of, if you have some handy skills, in terms of, you know, air sealing. And then we also, I really want to bring the message home that that'll get you so far, but really, to achieve the majority of the savings that are out there, most people will need to get an energy audit and to have the work done by a professional. And these audits cost. They cost $300 to $500 out there. Really important to know that there are a lot of financial incentives that are available right now for people to take advantage of them. You can go to the workshop to learn about it. For instance, Green Mountain Power will pay for, give you a check for $2,500 to help weatherize your house. They'll pay for the cost of your audit up to
$400. $2,500 to weatherize your house?
So they'll basically pay for a third of the project cost. So
why?
If you have a job that's $7,500, hold on. They'll pay up to $2,500. They'll give you a grant to cover that.
This is an investor-owned company. Why are they giving away $2,500?
This is part of their settlement. When Green Mountain Power was bought by a Canadian company.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name, some gas company up there. This is part of the settlement, so some of the financial benefits would go to the customers as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a few other programs. But, for instance, you know, Vermont Gas has a great program out there in terms of loan, grants and paying for audits, and there's various low-interest loans programs. So you come to the workshop and you find out what the programs, what the incentives are available, you know, to help cover these costs.
So we've been talking about lots of financial savings available to people and money they can get from various institutions, including their electric company, if they buy from Green Mountain Power. Who funds this Button Up Vermont program, Paul?
This program is run by Central Vermont Community Action Council, which is the community action agency that serves low-income people primarily in the Central Vermont region. But this is a statewide program under funds that were received under something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a carbon trading program that's in the Northeast. And these workshops are free. Emphasize free, no cost to come learn how you can save money. And you know, I can tell you there's a bunch of workshops coming up in your listening area, and I don't know how you want to handle that, whether you want to go through some of those. Or
well, why don't I just read off the list of those coming up November 11th through the 23rd is Westford, Chelsea, Tynemouth, South Burlington, Putney, Thetford, Starksboro, Huntington, Hardwick, Greensboro, Waterbury, and apparently a combined one in Warren and Waitsfield.
Yeah.
So that's an awful lot of them. I have put on the EqualTimeRadio.com website in the story about today's show a link to the page at, I believe it's at VEIC, about the Button Up Vermont program. And there you can download a complete schedule of the workshops, a PDF file. I assume that has all the information on where they are, exactly what time they start.
Right.
Is that correct?
It does. And you don't have to live in the town to go to them. These are available to anybody in any community. This is just the locations. They're organized by people within those communities, but they're not limited to people in those communities.
You could probably even sneak across the border from New Hampshire or New York or Quebec to go to them.
Well, I don't know. We do kind of check IDs to make sure at least you're a Vermonter. We don't want them to make any sure of them. Foreigners are in there, you know.
Don't want to have them saving energy.
No.
All right. Okay, well, this is a great program, Paul Markowitz. What have you changed this year besides adding a DVD component to it?
Well, it's a little bit shorter. The workshop, the slideshows are probably a little over an hour.
Okay.
We're encouraging the local organizers, people putting together the workshop in their communities, to have a series of speakers, not just the, you know, the professionals giving the slideshow, but, you know, somebody from the fire department to talk about, you know, wood burning wood safely, or maybe a solar installer talking about solar hot water. Just kind of, you know, short 3 to 5 minute presentations. We're encouraging them to have somebody who's had energy work done in their home from the community and talk about, kind of give a testimonial.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of this slideshow, speakers, and then the DVD on the how-to, you know, things that you can do in terms of air sealing in your home.
And is that DVD something that you'll get to take home with you, or you'll
we
see
provide,
it there?
We provide each community with 10 copies.
Okay.
That they can distribute as they will. Some are, you know, giving them away for free. Some are loaners.
Mm-hmm.
The DVD is available in every public library in the state.
Oh, very good.
Made that available. Very, very well received, the DVD.
Mm-hmm.
So people just, you know, in here, you know, you used to go out and you could spend $100 and you could get that paid for within, you know, a couple months in terms of the air savings, energy savings you would realize.
Say that one more time.
What I'm saying is that the energy savings opportunities that are available that we talk about in the DVD, I think the name of the DVD is Simple Weatherization Measures to Button Up Your Home.
Mm.
And these are relatively, you know, basically for the price of a caulk gun and or we also encourage a foam gun, which can cost, you know, $40-$50 plus the foam. You know, you could spend $100 and pay for itself. The cost of that investment will be paid for in energy savings, you know, within a heating season or a couple months, because, you know, if these measures aren't done, like the bulkhead door or your attic hatch, you know, those are huge areas of heat loss.
Got it. Paul Markowitz, thanks so much for joining us today.
Carl, thanks for having me.
That was a Button Up Vermont program. More information about that at our website, equaltimeradio.com. So we talked about transportation, which is responsible for half the CO2 and $4.3 billion of our spending a year in Vermont. In the first half of the show, we talked about saving money on your home heating bills. In the second half of the show, more information on our guests and how to contact them at our website, equaltimeradio.com. I'm Carl Etnayer. Thanks for the call from Chuck in Jericho. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. Thanks for tuning in.